Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. Andrew Yang is a tech and education entrepreneur from New York, the son of immigrant parents from Taiwan, the founder of a nonprofit, and the champion of universal basic income policies. As he runs for the Democratic nomination for president, he's warning of the coming dark side of automation, which may leave millions of Americans out of work in the coming decades. He's back in New Hampshire this weekend for a series of public events, and he's here in our studio this morning to talk about his campaign. What questions do you have for Andrew Yang? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And you can check out a live streaming video of this broadcast at our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word, NHPR Exchange. Andrew Yang, thank you very much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here, Peter. Thanks for having me.
So let's get to know you a little bit and your overall pitch. So you're an entrepreneur, as we mentioned. You don't have any military or political experience. What would you say makes you qualified to be president of the United States?
Well, I spent the last 7 years helping create several thousand jobs around the United States in places like Detroit, Cleveland, Baltimore, St. Louis, Birmingham. I was actually recognized by the Obama White House as both an ambassador of entrepreneurship and a champion of change for my work with Venture for America, the organization that I'd started. And to me, the reason why Donald Trump is our president today is that we'd automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, all the swing states he needed to win and did win. And my friends in technology know that what we did to the manufacturing jobs, we are now doing to the retail jobs, the call center jobs, the fast food jobs, and most disastrously soon, the truck driving jobs. So the reason why I'm running for president is that we need to solve the problems that got Donald Trump elected and move our society and economy forward in the 21st century. Unfortunately, none of our political leaders wants to take on this conversation, in large part because they don't understand technology. Many of them don't really even understand the economy. And that's why I'm running for president, to help move our country forward in a time of unprecedented economic and technological transformation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a question from Nicholas about the Democratic debates. You've qualified for the Democratic debates. You've met the party's threshold. Nicholas wants to know, in a crowded debate stage, how do you stand out and get your ideas taken seriously?
Well, the great thing about the debates, and people listening to this might be an exception, but most Americans have not started paying attention to 2020. They have a very vague sense of who's running. And the debates will be an opportunity to introduce myself to millions of Americans for the first time. So whatever question I get asked, like I have a strong feeling that it's going to relate to this economic and technological transformation that we're in the midst of, because it touches many facets of American life. And I believe that my problem-solving approach will stand out in a field of Democratic contenders very, very quickly. And the excitement will be high because most people tuning in, they'll look at me and say, who is that person? And then they'll Google Andrew Yang, as maybe some people will do after this conversation. They'll find out about me, the Freedom Dividend, my policies, and the campaign will only grow.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about those policies in this hour. Again, listeners, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Andrew Yang, this primary isn't your first time in New Hampshire. You were a student at Phillips Exeter.
Yeah, I was. I graduated in 1992, and I actually got to speak at Exeter a couple of months ago, which was a real treat. And what I said to the student body there was that it was my first time back in 27 years because I didn't really enjoy it there.
You didn't really enjoy it there. Why not?
Well, you know, I came in as a junior, which is somewhat unusual. And I found the environment just a bit difficult in terms of the competitiveness. And it's one thing when I spoke to the student body, like I asked them about it, where there was a sense that where you got into college was your value, essentially. And that might be true for students in high schools across the country, but it felt very true at Phillips Exeter. Though I will say, and I said to them, it was a phenomenal education. I would not be running for president if not for my time at Phillips Exeter, and I appreciate it a great deal.
Mm-hmm. One question that came in anonymously that we wanted to ask. You describe yourself as a human-centered capitalist. Do you think it is fair to compare your policies to New Deal Democratic policies?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels where the New Deal in many ways arose to the this historic challenge of that era where, you know, it was in the aftermath of the Great Depression. And right now it doesn't feel like we're in a Great Depression, but it does feel that way to some Americans. I mean, our life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years due to a surge in drug overdoses and suicides. 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. 57% say they can't afford an unexpected $500 bill. And so people are looking around and saying, wait a minute, if GDP is at a record high, why do things feel so lousy for many of us?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the signature policy that you've promoted, and that's universal basic income. You call it the freedom dividend. This is, in your view, $1,000 a month to every household or individual above the age of 18. I think it was an individual above the age of 18, yes?
Yeah, that's right. My flagship policy is that we should have a dividend where every American adult receives $1,000 a month starting at age 18. So if you're listening to this and you're 18 and over, you should receive $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year.
No requirements at all? It's just for basically for existing, or do they have to file a tax return? Or
it's there are no conditions at all to it.
No conditions at all. Okay. So why is that a good policy?
Well, first I want to talk about the history of it, where this is not my idea. Thomas Paine was for this at the founding of the country. He called it the citizen's dividend. Martin Luther King championed it in 1967, called it the guaranteed minimum income. Milton Friedman and 1,000 economists signed a study saying this would be tremendous for America. And it became law in one state in 1982, where now everyone in Alaska gets between $1,000 and $2,000 a year, no questions asked, as part of the petroleum fund. And the reason why this is so imperative, the reason I'm fighting for this, is that we are in the midst of the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of our country, what experts are calling the fourth industrial revolution. The five most common jobs in the economy are administrative work, retail, food service and food prep, truck driving and transportation, and manufacturing. And all five of those are contracting as we speak. If you're listening to this, have you noticed stores closing in your neighborhoods in New Hampshire? And if you have, you have to ask, why is that? And the reason is that Amazon is soaking up $20 billion in commerce every year, and it's now causing 30% of your malls and stores to close. Working in retail is the most common job here in New Hampshire, as it is in most other parts of the country. The average retail worker is a 39-year-old woman making between $10 and $11 an hour. What does she do when the store closes? What do the truck drivers do when the robot trucks come in 5 to 10 years? So we have to wake up to the fact that it is not immigrants that are causing these economic dislocations. It is technology led to Donald Trump, and it's just going to get more and more accelerated as artificial intelligence truly starts transforming company operations.
Mm-hmm. So why $1,000? How did you come up with that number?
Well, $1,000, this plan was proposed by a guy named Andy Stern, who used to run the largest labor union in the country, the SEIU, and it was studied by the Roosevelt Institute. And $12,000 a year for every adult would be a game changer, but it's not enough where it's going to completely transform our labor markets overnight, because $12,000 is below the U.S. poverty line of $12,770. So it's a difference maker, but it's not going to take away anyone's need to go out there and do work and try and improve themselves and their situations, because obviously you're not going to be able to flourish on $1,000 a month. But $1,000 a month in the hands of everyone in New Hampshire, it grows your consumer economy by more than 15%. It creates 20,000 new jobs right here in New Hampshire, because your Main Street businesses grow, that money flows to local services, car repairs, tutoring for kids, the occasional night out, and most of the money stays right here in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. You are currently giving $1,000 a month to a New Hampshire family, the Fossey family, Jody, Chuck, and their daughter, Janelle. They live in Goffstown, and you chose them from a group of families that applied for this. So we reached out to them this week to see how this has impacted them.
My name is Jody Fossey.
My name is Chuck Fossey.
And we've been receiving $1,000 a month starting January 1st of 2019 from Andrew Yang's personal account. I've been taking the money and putting it in the bank, and we've been holding it for added expenses. Like today, my car's in the shop, and that's going to be a $300 expense. So we have Andrew's money to pay that instead of throwing it on a credit card.
It's changed our life to a certain extent. I mean, most of it is going towards Janelle's college, but obviously it's freed up some money so we could do other things, like I'm actually taking improv classes for my mental health. Obviously, I wouldn't have been doing that if we didn't have the income.
So that's the two members of the Fossey family speaking about this $1,000 a month freedom dividend that you were giving them as, I guess you would call it an experiment to see how it works here in New Hampshire and how it might work as part of your campaign. Yes?
Well, there's the abstraction and then there's the real. So if someone comes here to New Hampshire and says, hey, we should really start giving everyone $1,000 a month to help help make our children and families stronger and healthier, help us all manage this incredible transition, that's abstract. If you say, hey, your neighbor is getting $1,000 a month, and look, they're healthier, happier, less stressed out, stronger, and then that becomes real. You know, people who know the Fossey family, it's like, yeah, I know Chuck and Jody, and they're good people. And then all of the concerns you have about people getting money kind of disappear too, because some of us are programmed for resource scarcity, where if you say people are getting money, it's like, oh, that's going to hurt them. Then you see it in real life in the Fossey family. It's like, wait, why the heck would getting $1,000 a month hurt anyone?
Mm-hmm. Well, do the benefits of receiving $1,000 a month diminish if we're all getting it? In other words, will that sort of raise the floor for everybody and then everything will become more expensive because everybody can proportionately afford more in theory?
It does not have that effect. And many, many studies have shown that if you get money, what it does is it improves your health and nutrition, your mental health. It reduces your stress levels. And it has nothing to do with whether someone else is getting an equivalent amount of money. There's also no reason to think that all of a sudden things are going to get more expensive because, let's say, the burger joint decides to charge an extra $3 for a burger. Just because you're getting $1,000 a month doesn't mean all of a sudden you're like, sure, I'll pay. I'll pay $10 for a burger. That was $7 yesterday. You know, it's like you're still price sensitive. There's still competition for your business. And so there is no negative effect of doing this with everybody. Your $1,000 is still your $1,000.
Mm-hmm. What about paying for it? Because you mentioned earlier that in Alaska they have the petroleum fund that funds that dividend that Alaskans get. Is there an equivalent national policy that could fund this?
Very much so. And if you look up, so again, recall Amazon is sucking up $20 billion in business, closing 30% of your stores. You like Amazon in terms of its convenience, but you do have this uneasy feeling. You're like, wow, like, where is this heading? How much did Amazon pay in federal taxes in 2018? Zero. So think about what that means. A $1 trillion tech company paid less in federal taxes than you did. And so then when you look around and say, okay, how do we fund this freedom dividend? In Alaska, they fund it with oil money. And what is the oil of the 21st century? Technology is the oil of the 21st century. And the way we fund this for the people in New Hampshire is we have a new tax that falls most heavily on the Amazons, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Ubers, the companies that are going to benefit the most from AI and automation.
Mm-hmm. What about wealthy people in general, not just ones connected with the tech industry? I mean, some candidates have said that we need to be taxing America's wealthiest more. Is that something that you are in favor of?
Well, the tax I have in mind is a value-added tax that would fall most heavily on wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals. And so that is the most efficient way to get those resources into the hands of the American people. And other advanced economies have all uniformly adopted a value-added tax because it is the most efficient way.
Mm-hmm. We have this question from Phil in New Jersey.
Hey, does your universal income proposal differ from Milton Friedman's? Would it replace any government programs or add to existing liabilities?
So that's the question from Phil.
Yeah, so Milton Friedman's flagship proposal is a negative income tax, which Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, just came out and said we should do that. And what that is it's a guaranteed income where if you make below a certain amount of money, you get trued up to that level. So the dividend is slightly different than Milton Friedman's in that we don't actually monitor your income level and we give you the money regardless. So ours is closer to Alaska than Milton Friedman's, but the principle is very much the same for a lot of the same reasons. Now, Milton Friedman's plan wanted to do away with many of the existing social programs. And I think that's the wrong way to go because there are many, many Americans who rely upon various programs and benefits for their month-to-month needs. And so my plan would have the Freedom Dividend sit alongside existing social programs. But if you opt into the Freedom Dividend, then you forego benefits from the existing social programs.
So you could choose one or the other, is what you're saying?
Yes, and this would reduce enrollments in the social programs over time, which many people would cheer because, you know, there's a lot of bureaucracy and administration and some negative incentives attached to those programs.
So would you say that people would have to choose between, say, expanded Medicaid and the Freedom Dividend?
This does not touch health care. So when I'm talking about existing social programs, I'm talking about cash and cash equivalents.
Okay. We also have this call from Faith in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Andrew. My name is Faith from Austin, Texas. My question is, would you support initiatives for educating all dividend recipients about budgeting, managing finances, and how to make the most of our $1,000 a month?
Yes, I'm a huge fan of financial literacy as an intrinsic part of education at the high school level. And so the Freedom Dividend would kick in at age 18. So imagine all the parents out there being able to look at your child and say, hey, your country loves you. You're important, you're an American, and you get $1,000 a month starting at age 18. And by the way, you have to take this financial literacy class your senior in high school before you get it. That's a game changer. And think about all of those effects throughout that person's life. So that's exactly where we need to go. And for adults, obviously, there'd be a financial literacy program available for people regardless of their age or stage.
Mm-hmm. Regarding the $1,000 a month that you're giving to the Fossey family, you initially didn't disclose that you were giving this money to the Fosseys on your campaign expense report. That was reported by the Des Moines Register this week. Has that now been corrected?
Yeah, if it hasn't been corrected, it's literally in the mail. And we had a call with the FEC clearing the fact that I was giving the Fossey family's money. And obviously, we weren't hiding it because it was literally front page news.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was literally just like, does this qualify as a campaign expense or not? Our call with the FEC initially suggested that it was that it did not need to be. But as soon as someone said otherwise, then we just amended it.
Okay. We had a question from Serge who asks, are you going to deal with inflation if you give Americans $1,000 a month?
Yeah, so the $1,000 a month will be pegged to core inflation. And that's necessary because the intention is to help Americans meet their basic needs. But you have to look around and say, inflation has been a non-factor for the last number of years, even when we printed $4 trillion to bail out Wall Street in the financial crisis. There are three areas in American life that have experienced an inflation, and unfortunately, they're the three that are making us miserable: education, healthcare, and housing. So what we have to do is we have to attack those sources of inflation, and the $1,000 a month would actually help families bear those increased costs as we start to hopefully bring each of them down in turn.
Mm-hmm. We got a question from Alea who says, Andrew, will retirees who have been paying into the Social Security system for decades still be able to receive the Freedom Dividend?
So at present, we are making the Freedom Dividend as, again, a floor. And when I've talked to retirees around Social Security, it's often the case that if you are a couple, that one of you is receiving more than $1,000 and one of you is receiving less, because perhaps one of you took time off from work in order to take care of the kids, and so your work history is less developed. So if one couple, I think it was here in New Hampshire, actually said it's like the husband is receiving something like $1,400 in Social Security, and then the wife is receiving $400. So then with a freedom dividend, the wife would receive $1,000, and so that family's income would go up $600.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the question that some have raised regarding the $1,000 a month you're already giving to the Fossey family. Some may say that would sort of influence them to vote for you. Is that not quite vote buying, but it has a whiff of that. What would you respond to that?
Well, if you talk to the Fossey family, you'll find that they can vote however they'd like, and that there's been absolutely no obligation or commitment on their part to do so. Their only commitment was to take the $1,000 and do something positive with it. And even that, obviously, it's up to them, just as it should be up to the American people. These are our resources, really, and it's up to the individuals what to make of them. And certainly, the Fasces are going to vote however they'd like.
Mm-hmm. Central to the argument about the need for universal basic income for the freedom dividend is that artificial intelligence, automation, as you mentioned, going to eliminate many, many jobs in the coming decades. Is it wise for us to also stop the advance of technology? Is that an appropriate policy?
Well, in many ways, that's the path we're headed down, where Americans are going to look up and start to fear the arrival of many of these technologies. There are 3.5 million truck drivers in this country. There are thousands here in New Hampshire. And my friends are working on trucks that can drive themselves that should be on the highways in the next 5 to 10 years. So do we think that there are going to be protests saying, hey, we need to ban robot trucks? Very, very likely. When artificial intelligence starts displacing tens, hundreds of thousands of call center workers in the next number of years, do we think that there are going to be protests? Very, very likely. Do I believe that that's going to be successful? Almost certainly not.
The protests will not be successful.
The protest, yeah, because only 13% of truck drivers are unionized. And the cost savings around automating truck driving are $168 billion per year. And there are even climate benefits where you can increase fuel efficiency. There are equipment utilization benefits because the trucks never need to stop. You might save lives because 4,000 Americans die in accidents with human truck drivers every year. So this is the clash we are heading towards. And if we think we can regulate our way out of it by forestalling progress, what's going to happen is that you will see this intense lobbying of the government to protect certain industries while others fall by the wayside, because no one's lobbying to protect the malls, like in the retail workers, and if you think that's not artificial intelligence, you're not paying attention, because if you go to the closest Amazon fulfillment warehouse, you'll see it's wall-to-wall robots and they're investing billions in AI. So it's not like the robot walks into the mall and, starts selling you things, but it's the robots in the Amazon warehouse that are making those malls obsolete. It is almost impossible to try and forestall this at every element of the economy.
Mm-hmm. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking today with Andrew Yang, entrepreneur and presidential candidate in New Hampshire's 2020 primary. Your questions for him are welcome. Give us a call now. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, or watch the live video of this radio program at our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Just because you binge-watched West Wing does not mean you understand how government works. And that is okay. NHPR's new podcast, Civics 101, reviews the fundamentals that you learned in school and then forgot. Like, what exactly does a chief of staff do?
Most presidents don't like firing people.
Subscribe to Civics 101 on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Schoolhouse Rock meets politics for grown-ups.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with Andrew Yang today. He's running for the Democratic nomination for president, and your questions are welcome. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 6477. You can also send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page as you watch the live streaming video of this conversation. So, Andrew Yang, you've run two companies, one Manhattan Prep, which you sold to Kaplan Test Prep, and then you found Adventure for America, a nonprofit putting recent grads and startups in cities across the United States. In your book, you called these post-industrial cities. We've got a few of those in New Hampshire. You've traveled around New Hampshire now. What would you do with a city like Claremont or Berlin, post-industrial cities that are struggling here in New Hampshire?
So there's like a double or triple whammy occurring in many of these communities. So you get rid of the industrial employer, the labor base, and then people start casting about for opportunities. The tax base shrinks. The schools start to shrink. And then the real estate taxes go up because you need to somehow pay for the existing school infrastructure among a smaller population. You can't sell your home because property values, no one wants to buy into the declining town that now has higher real estate taxes. And so that it's a very, very difficult situation. And it's, in my opinion, why Donald Trump won in many of these post-industrial areas. I was staggered by the aftermath of the automation of work. And if you think it's globalization, you're partially right, but most of it's automation. According to studies, 80% of the lost manufacturing jobs in this country were due to technology and machines and not globalization.
Jobs are not going overseas. They're just becoming automated by robots.
Yes. And now we're in the process of automating away even the jobs that are overseas. It's just this inexorable trend. So the path forward for places like Claremont and Berlin is to say, look, we get it. We have done a number on your communities. And the best path forward is for you all to get $1,000 a month. That's going to help manage this transition. And help you pay for your schools and local communities. It will help rebuild your local economy. It will give your kids at least a path forward, a leg up, and a means to start exploring different alternatives. The tough part, Peter, is that the solution that's been sold to many communities is education and retraining, which has been a bust in most every instance. Independent studies show that success rates are between 0 and 15% for federally funded retraining programs for manufacturing workers in the Midwest. So we have to stop overhyping and overselling the education and retraining of workers and start just sending economic resources into people's hands so that communities can better manage the transition in their own ways.
Well, you're an education guy. I mean, you've thought hard about education policy. Is there something inherently wrong with the way federal policies have tried to retrain people? Or are they, no matter what you do, just not effective?
Well, the most effective retraining programs start with the job in mind. So what I mean by that is you go to an employer and say, hey, what do you need? And they say, this is what we need, but we can't find them. Be like, all right, let's see if we can train people for that. Now, if you're in an environment where you just lost the employer, then it's hard to find like another employer necessarily in that community or vicinity that needs the talent. And so that's really the government's the government is the wrong actor, because the government's natural proclivity will just be to say, what's that? We have 1,000 people who just lost their jobs. Let's retrain them. And so you don't start with the new employer with the set of skills that they require. And so one of the things we need to do is we need to stop overselling college to our young people, and we need to dramatically build up our vocational, technical, and apprenticeship programs. Only 6% of American high school students are in technical training. In Germany, it's 59%. So think about that gulf. And a lot of those technical jobs are wanting for workers right now around the country. And those jobs are more difficult to automate in many circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Matt in Concord. Matt, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My point is that humans tend to just kind of apply the current state to how they view technology will develop. And they had the same argument 100 years ago when cars displaced horses and, you know, intercontinental or transcontinental roads were built and the travel industry emerged. So nobody foresaw that the displacement of horses would cause a new industry of travel. And in a similar way, it's challenging for us to imagine what jobs will result what industries will result from AI and deep learning and, you know, other technologies. So I think we're only looking at it in our current lens, and that doesn't fully explain the jobs that will develop.
Yeah, so it is 100% the case that there will be new jobs that we have not anticipated, as has happened in every other technological shift. But it's also the case that those jobs will be for different people in different places with different skill sets than the folks that are being displaced. So if you say to the let's call it 500,000 truck drivers, say, hey, your trucks now drive themselves, you're out of a job. You're a 49-year-old man who used to make $46,000 a year, and now you make close to nothing. But rejoice that there are now new logistics managers based in Seattle that are managing the self-driving trucks. Like, don't you feel great about that? It's like, of course that driver does not care that there are these unanticipated jobs in another part of the country for folks with degrees in, you know, engineering or logistics management. I mean, you know, and if you use horses as an example, the population of horses declined a great deal. So of course, you know, cars led to many wondrous things. But if you were a horse, then maybe your lot did not improve.
Or someone who handles horses, we should say.
Or someone who handles horses. This is true. Thank you, Peter.
So, let's talk a little bit about another policy that you had, which is the American Scorecard. You want to change the key measurements we use to measure economic prosperity. So out with GDP, in with the American Scorecard. Explain, what is the American Scorecard in your view?
So again, GDP is at a record high while our life expectancy has declined for the last 3 years. So think about that. It's like, why do we care that GDP is at a record high if our people are dying of drugs and suicides at unprecedented levels? And as someone who's run organizations, if you have the wrong measurements, you'll never make progress. So how would we actually measure progress in the 21st century in ways that would actually, you know, would benefit us and would excite us? So I'm suggesting mental health and freedom from substance abuse would be a core measurement. Life expectancy and health, average income and affordability, childhood success rates. And this is very important to me. I'm a parent of two young boys, one of whom is autistic. And how does my wife's work with my children get calculated in GDP? Right now it's zero. You know, do we think that's an accurate representation of her work? How clean our air and water are. So this is the American Scorecard. We can actually measure our economic progress in these ways. And this turns our kids' education into investment, because then you look at our kids and say, well, if we get more of our kids to become stronger and healthier, then that's actually progress. If we stick with GDP, we are sunk, because robot trucks will be tremendous for GDP and they will be terrible for the people of New Hampshire and many people around the country.
So you're suggesting changing the metrics to essentially incentivize us as a country to focus on different things to keep the new metric up.
Yes. And the great thing is, as president, thank you, New Hampshire, but as president in 2021, I can just go down the street to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics and say, hey, guys, GDP, very old and out of date, kind of useless. Here are the new stats we're going to be using. And then, and they already have the stats. We just need to, you know, start reporting on them. And then every year at the State of the Union, I will present these stats to you, the American people. I will be the first president to use PowerPoint in the State of the Union so we can actually keep track of how we're doing.
Listeners, we're speaking today with 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. He's here in the studio to take your calls and spell out his policies ahead of the first in the nation presidential primary in New Hampshire. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. While we're on the subject of the economy, I want to ask you about tariffs. As of this morning, President Trump has followed through on his threat to boost tariffs on roughly $200 billion of Chinese products from 10% to 25%, the latest escalation in an ongoing trade war. What do you make of this approach?
Well, I would not go down the tariff road. I was just in Iowa, so politician-y, but I was just in Iowa, and there are farmers who are furious that they spent 6 years building up relationships that now have been thrown aside because their goods are not competitive because of Chinese tariffs that have been enacted in response to our tariffs. So this is something that's going to hurt workers and businesses on both sides. There are legitimate imbalances with the Chinese, the China-U.S. trade relationship that we should be working to address. But the tariffs are going to be hurtful to people here in America, and you know, and people who built relationships for years trying to grow their exports abroad.
Quick question about tax returns, then I want to talk about healthcare. Your campaign pledged a month ago to release several years of your tax returns in the coming weeks. Have you followed through on that pledge?
We're talking to the accountant right now. I mean, it could be happening as we speak. My tax returns are quite dull. I've run a nonprofit for the last several years, so you can kind of imagine what those tax returns look like. They'll be a matter of public record in the days to come.
Mm-hmm. And should it be a requirement for presidential candidates to disclose these?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like the American people have to know where your interests lie. And clearly, let's say hypothetically, you were getting money from a foreign government. Then that's of natural interest to the American people.
So healthcare, you support Medicare for all. How would you roll out such a program?
The most straightforward way to do so is to lower the eligibility age over time and then allow the government to negotiate for lower prices on treatments and drugs. And so you'd phase it in over a multi-year period.
How many years do you think?
You know, optimistically, you could get it done in, let's say, 5 to 10 years.
5 to 10 years. Okay. And what about paying for it?
Well, this is one of the biggest misconceptions around the healthcare debate, is that we're spending twice as much on our healthcare as other countries to worse results. There is so much money flowing into that system that we almost can't help but save money as soon as you have any kind of rationalizing of costs. And this is someone who's paid for health insurance for dozens, hundreds of employees over the years, where there's a lot of money that's getting plowed into that system. And so if we take that burden off of companies and employers, it's going to be a huge win, because then it'll make it easier to hire people, easier to start businesses, easier to change jobs. So this is actually a very pro-growth, pro-economy move, and there's plenty of cost savings to be had in the system.
Mm-hmm. What about insurance companies? They're obviously going to have something to say about a Medicare for all policy. How would you manage insurance companies and their interests?
Well, you know, the unfortunate truth is that if you have an effective public option, many private insurers will cease to exist over time, and that's bad for them. But it's good for the American people, because the private health and insurance industry ends up being an intermediary that elevates costs in many situations. And, you know, if we just say, well, we can't make a change because, you know, people work for these companies, then we're never going to be able to make progress. It's one reason why the Freedom Dividend is so important, is that it helps us make transitions in a way that still enables Americans to have their heads up and not think that they're, you know, going to be out on the street.
You may have already answered this question, but I just want to be clear for Steve's sake. He wrote in with this question. He says, I'm a father of two. My wife and I struggle to pay for high cost of health care. It's a drain on our wallets. How would you bring down costs?
Yes. So it is perverse in the richest and most advanced economy in the history of the world that when you get sick or injured, you're more stressed out about paying for treatment than you are getting well. And we can afford to change that. And so to the extent that you have these outrageous bills, we can get the cost down just by any kind of negotiation over price. And we all know the healthcare industry prices are completely insane and out of whack and arbitrary, and like they cost different things in different places. If you start identifying the true costs of these things, then the price goes way down very, very quickly. And if we move towards a Medicare for all, then you'd be focused on getting healthy and not trying to pay for treatment.
You've also suggested a new salary model for doctors, like the one they use at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, sort of a flat rate salary for doctors rather than a price for service model. How do you believe this would change the system?
I have many friends who are doctors. I'm Asian, after all. They know that their financial incentives are to do more and more and to see more patients in a particular time frame. And so at the Cleveland Clinic, you get paid a healthy salary. Let's call it, you know, $175,000. And then you do what's best for the patient. You spend less time chasing billables. You maybe say, hey, look, you might not need this procedure. You might not need this treatment. Shocker, when doctors don't get paid on a per procedure basis, all of a sudden they don't think as many people need the procedure. You know,
and or perhaps so, they don't also practice defensive medicine, maybe?
Yes. There's also the fact that many people are doing extra activities because they don't want to get sued later. It's like a sort of a self-protection thing, whether or not they think it's in our interest as patients. Now, we're going to have to level with people who are going into the medical industry, say, look, you're going to be respected, admired, help people every day, but you're not going to become mega wealthy in this arena the way you might have in past years. And if some people say, well, I wanted to be a doctor to become mega wealthy, then it's like, well, okay, then, you might have, well, we're going to make this transition so that, you know, like, it's going to take a bit of time. But anyone new coming into the industry should know that this is not the path to riches. This is the path to a very, very comfortable life helping people, which is the way it ought to be.
And I can hear some doctors saying, well, fine, but what are you going to do about my massive medical school debt? Might want to put a bookmark in that part of the conversation. We'll talk about education in the third part of the program. But I did want to bring into this conversation right now Judy in Keene. Judy, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air. Judy, you're on the air. What's your question or comment?
I'm sorry. I'm having trouble with the connection here.
We can hear you just fine, Judy. What's your question?
I have had the misfortune, and I use the word advisedly, of living in two different countries where value-added tax was imposed at the time that it was. And I think it's a terrible tax. Contrary to what Mr. Yang said, it falls most heavily on the poor because it occupies a larger percentage of what they have to spend. There's a sharp inflationary spike when it takes hold, and it makes a heavy paperwork load on industry at all levels, top to bottom. I think it is terrible. I will not vote for anybody who is advocating it, and I will urge anybody I can find not to.
And Judy, can you tell us really quickly what country you were living in where there was a value-added tax that you found burdensome?
First in Israel and later in Greece.
All right, Judy, thank you very much for the call. So, Andrew Yang, you mentioned value-added tax as being a way to pay for things like the freedom dividend. Judy says it's not such a great idea.
Well, certainly, if you're in a country, when it gets adopted that first time, there's a bit of an adjustment period. But every other advanced economy has already made this move, and we would precede it by putting $1,000 a month into people's hands. And so in the absence of you actually receiving a dividend, which is going to increase your purchasing power by $12,000 a year, then it is true that, you know, it would be irritating to see certain prices go up. We can also exempt consumer staples that are consumed by people who are, you know, like parents, like diapers and milk and like all these things that people consume all the time. But we have to make this move because every other advanced economy has already figured out that this is the way to keep the Amazons of the world from paying zero in taxes. And the reason why Israel and Europe and Canada and China and Japan, like everyone has this, is because they know it's the most efficient way to keep very rich companies from playing games and moving all their tax burden to other countries where they can shield it.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking today with Andrew Yang, entrepreneur, presidential candidate in New Hampshire's 2020 primary. And your questions are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I'm Jason Moon, host of the Bear Brook podcast from NHPR. Join me for a live show now at City Space in Boston on May 14th. I'll speak about how we produced Bear Brook, the controversial science that helped crack open the case, and how that science is changing criminal investigations all across the country. Get your tickets now at wbur.org/cityspace. See you there.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with Andrew Yang today. He's running for the Democratic nomination for president. Give us a call if you have a question for him. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page where you can watch a live streaming video of our conversation. You can find it on Facebook by searching for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. So before the break, we spoke briefly about education and student debt in particular. We were talking about it in the context of doctors, but there are many people of many fields of study that have lots of college debt. So Andrew Yang, what would you do about that debt load?
Yeah, it's immoral what we've done to our young people in particular. Though there are Americans at every demographic that are struggling with student loan debt. We're up to $1.5 trillion in educational loans, up from less than $100 billion in 1999. So think about that, up 15-fold. And it's constraining our young people. The average debt load now is $38,000 for a recent college grad. And a recent college graduate has a 44% chance of doing a job that doesn't require a college degree. So think about that, $38,000 in debt, and you're doing a job that doesn't require the degree that you spent years getting. So we are, again, overselling college to young people. And one big step we have to take is we do have to reduce the cost of these degrees. Now, if you trace why college has gone up in price 250% since when I went to college, it has not gotten 250% better. It's just gotten 250% more expensive because of an incredible growth in administrators. And so we have to try and rein in these costs at educational institutions. And I would forgive a significant proportion of this $1.5 trillion in student loan debt, because our young people should be starting families, buying homes, starting businesses, and moving our country forward, and not all living in their families' basements trying to pay off loans for years and years.
Can you specify what that significant proportion would be?
Yeah, so we're looking at a couple of different approaches. So one approach that we're looking at is a 10 by 10, where if you were to commit 10% of your wages for 10 years, then you're debt-free. And so depending upon your debt load, that could amount to tens of thousands of dollars. But we're looking at forgiving a majority of that student loan debt. And if you question the source of that, again, remember, we printed $4 trillion to bail out the Wall Street banks. And this is a stimulus of the people, where every dollar we forgive of student loan debt will end up getting spent back in the economy, because that person will then have the freedom to spend that money on moving our country forward.
So you're saying print money to do that? I mean, is that a justification? We did it before. Let's do it again.
Well, it's a justification in the sense that whenever anyone's looking around saying, like, wait, like, where, like, how are we going to do this? It's like, well, does anyone remember voting on the Wall Street bailout? You guys remember the referendum where we said, hey, do you want to either forgive the people who have these mortgages on their homes and keep them in their homes, or do you want to bail out Wall Street? You remember voting on that? I do not remember voting on that. And so we have to make a decision as to what we value. Do we value the financial institutions who now hold this $1.5 trillion in student loan debt, or do we value our people? And I think we should value our people much more highly.
Mm-hmm. In our limited time left, I do want to make sure we hit on a variety of subjects, including immigration. You see a path to citizenship as essential, and deporting the massive number of illegal immigrants in the United States as a non-starter because, I'll quote you here, it would be prohibitively expensive, disruptive, and inhumane to many communities. You said we must secure our border and then provide a pathway. How do you propose going about that?
Well, it's as you quoted there. We have to stop pretending it's even remotely feasible to deport 12 million undocumented immigrants to this country, where it would collapse regional economies, it would separate families. It's just completely a non-starter. So then what's left? Well, another option is we just do what we're doing now, which is just pretend no one's here, and then we end up having problems every time someone gets in a car accident or winds up in an emergency room or ends up interacting with institutions in various ways. So the only reasonable path forward is to say, look, there are 12 million plus people who are here. We need to start figuring out who they are. And the only way to do that is to say, like, look, here's like a path forward that if you were to pay taxes and keep a clean criminal record for a number of years, then there's actually a destination for you where you can be an American over time. I mean, we're talking about like a decades-long process. I'm the son of immigrants myself. I believe that immigrants make our country stronger economically and culturally. But we do need to strike a balance here, because at this point, the current situation serves no one's interests.
Mm-hmm. You said you'd like to work with the Mexican government to maintain border security. The current policy is for those seeking entrance to the U.S. from Mexico stay in Mexico while they await a hearing. and the Mexican government is complying with this strategy. Is this the right move for people seeking asylum?
Well, right now, the asylum process at our southern border is no one's idea of the right way to go, where you have months or even like over a year-long wait. And if someone's here in the U.S., they don't get detained. They just sort of walk away. And then when it's time for their hearing, often they don't show up. And so is that the system we want? Obviously not. And so if there's a way to have them await their hearing in Mexico, that's preferable. Ideally, we have a hearing in less than a year. The problem is we're having trouble staffing an adequate number of judges at the border and social workers and facilities. So we need to invest resources in having our actual processes function the way they're designed. But in a bad situation, having people stay on the Mexican side of the border, it would be preferable to just letting them walk around the U.S. and probably not show up the next year.
Let's talk to Fred, who's calling from Kansas. Fred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Andrew.
Yes.
So what is your plan for prison rehabilitation and rehabilitation for addicts?
Well, thanks. It's such an important question, Fred. And we have to invest much more in the way of resources for people who are coming back into society, both from incarceration and also are struggling with addiction. I know there are many people here in New Hampshire that have family members and friends who've been struggling with addiction, that there are, I believe there's the third highest rate of overdose and substance abuse here in the state. And so one of the things that I'm for is I'm for decriminalizing opiates, that if you're caught with opiates, we need to refer you to treatment and not a prison cell. And there are many people who are resisting confronting their problem because they're afraid they're going to have criminal penalties. Other countries have decriminalized opiates and found that it reduces overdose rates and usage rates over time. And we should do the same thing, particularly when it's the case that the U.S. government was delinquent and allowing this opiate plague to get originated in the first place, when it turned a blind eye to Purdue Pharma issuing OxyContin prescriptions here in New Hampshire and around the country.
So when you say decriminalized opiates, which ones are you referring to, just to put a fine point on it? Are we talking about just the ones that you get with a prescription from your doctor, which are decriminalized, of course, if you have a prescription, but also heroin and fentanyl, these kind of things?
Yes, because we all know that what starts with OxyContin then moves to heroin and fentanyl because they're cheaper and easier to access in many cases. So I'm not talking just about Oxy. I'm talking about heroin and fentanyl as well.
Mm-hmm. And how do you imagine society dealing with suddenly having heroin be legal?
Well, it's not legal in the sense that, you know, you're selling it. It's legal in the sense that if I catch you with it, you don't go to jail. We take your heroin away. Unless you're a heroin dealer, so we're talking about heroin for personal use. If we catch you with a supply that suggests, or we catch you selling it, then you go to jail. Like, I'm not saying heroin is a legal drug.
Okay.
I'm saying that if we catch you with heroin, you don't go to jail, you go to treatment.
Understood. Okay. Want to ask you a question about abortion. As states make efforts to challenge Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court, voters are going to want to know where you stand on abortion. So what's your position on that?
I think it is not a male legislator's place to weigh in on women's reproductive rights. So I think women should make their own determinations as to what reproductive rights are. I have a feeling we know where women will come out. In terms of the Supreme Court, there is no rule in the Constitution about the number of justices. It has been higher than nine and lower than nine at different points in time. And so I'd be interested in trying to depoliticize the Supreme Court by making it so that we have 18-year appointments instead of lifetime appointments, which would then make it more predictable and less of a firestorm, and we're not freaking out about, you know, whether Ruth Bader Ginsburg gets a cold this week. But I believe that we should be protecting women's reproductive rights at the highest levels.
So just to clarify, you would not support legislation that would ban abortion?
No, I would not. I mean, it's again, I don't think it's my place to be weighing in. In terms of like what women want to do with their reproductive rights, but I would certainly not be supporting anything that's restricting those rights.
Mm-hmm. With respect to gun laws, we've seen two tragic shootings on American campuses in the past few weeks. What, if anything, do you think should be done to America's gun laws?
I think that most Americans agree that we need to move in the direction of more common sense gun safety legislation. I think it should be treated similarly to the way we treat vehicle ownership, where you get licensed and tested because, you know, you can run someone over and kill them. It's like, guess what? You can shoot someone and kill them too. So, you know, we should take gun ownership very seriously. I do think, though, that the related problem is that we need to have a massive mental health initiative in this country, because we can see around us, I mean, anxiety, depression are all at record highs, suicide record highs. And this is very much touching the epidemic of gun violence that we're seeing. And so gun safety is one aspect and mental health is another.
We had a question from Dylan. The Second Amendment is near and dear to many Americans, says Dylan. You push for licensing and safety, but will you implement a national registry that is mandatory?
Well, I agree that Second Amendment rights are near and dear to many Americans. And right now, a registry is not and something that I've proposed. But I do think there is much more we can do. One thing I'm very interested in is making signature guns more commercially widespread and freely available, where you're the only person who can fire your gun.
Like a fingerprint scan before it fires? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, they even can do something where it's like a grip recognition, mm-hmm. where it can just tell that it's you because of the pressure in various points on the grip. And a lot of gun owners would love that because it makes your gun really cool and it makes us safer because if someone else gets a hold of that gun, they can't fire it.
Mm-hmm. Last question comes from Thomas with respect to the military. He writes, if you were to become president, would you plan to make any changes to the current military budget?
Yes, right now we're spending $750 billion we know of on our military. And a lot of that is being spent on threats that may not be the paramount threats of today. So what I would want to do is channel a significant part of our military budget to infrastructure spending, which would create many jobs. There's going to be an ongoing need. We have tens of thousands of derelict buildings like around the country and here in New Hampshire that communities don't have the resources to properly dispose of. And so that's where I think we should be investing at least some of the $750 billion that we're currently putting into the military.
Well, Andrew Yang, thank you very much for coming and spelling out some of your policies today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I had a great time, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Yang is an entrepreneur and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate. You can find all of our conversations with candidates running for president at nhpr.org/primary2020. And remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Rebecca Lavoie is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.